Hello, everyone. I'm Bill Roggio. I'm a senior fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies and editor of FDD's Lone War Journal. This is Generation Jihad, the podcast that covers all things in what used to be known as the global war on terror, but we now call the long war. Today is Friday. Typically, my co-host is Benham, but the Benham is unavailable today. So I have a special guest, my friend, colleague, David Daoud. He's a senior fellow at FDD, where he focuses on Lebanon and Hezbollah. And David has a wealth of knowledge on the region. David, welcome to Generation Jihad. Great to have you back.
Great to be back, Bill.
Yeah, David, looking forward to today's talk. I really enjoyed our last discussion, really enjoyed our talk. So I was looking forward to getting you back on. I guess today is the perfect day to get you back. So we'll talk some Hezbollah. We'll talk, you know, where does the war stand? But to start off, since it's the newsy item, and I think it is important that we discuss. Last night, during the State of the Union, President Biden announced that the U.S. was going to build a temporary port or pier. It's kind of unclear what that is, to deliver aid to Palestinian civilians in Gaza. This is a quote from the speech. I said, quote, no U.S. boots will be on the ground. End quote. I could just, all I can say is good luck with that. I wonder how you're going to build a port, a dock. I'm sure the military has some ways. But it's not just building it, but how are you going to deliver that aid without interacting with people, whether it's on that pier, port, or on the ground in Gaza? Because who are you going to cooperate with? Somebody has to pick that. You have to drop that aid off and someone has to pick it up. Is it going to be Hamas? Is it going to be, who are we working with here? But more importantly, I'm getting a sort of a Mogadishu 1993 meets Kabul, August 2021 vibe here. You know, this is these well-intentioned humanitarian, and David, you had mentioned to me, you had said Beirut in 1983, right? Yeah. Probably 1982, probably even more apt here, right? Well-intentioned involvements can turn bad really fast. And the real cherry on top here, if we're going to do this, the U.S. isn't going to get any hostages back. So we're basically going to provide aid into Gaza without getting anything in return. There's still, people forget. I mean, look, if it was any other president in office right now, we would be getting a daily reminder of how many U.S. hostages are being held in captivity by Hamas. But that is just completely buried. I guarantee I didn't watch the State of the Union. I just could never stomach them. I don't care who's in office. They're just odd campaign speeches. But I can guarantee you there was no talk of freeing U.S. hostages. That's our tax dollars at work, right? Going to provide aid to get nothing in return. David, what are your thoughts on this news? I realize it's a little different from Hezbollah and Lebanon, but you have experience with these type of issues. And as well as, you know, tap into your knowledge and expertise on international law, I'd love to hear your opinion.
Look, I think it's a noble idea in theory, right? There's also a tactical benefit to it in that if you want to prolong the war, which it does need to be prolonged because Hamas has not been destroyed yet, the way to do that is to alleviate the suffering of the coincidental or the collateral suffering, rather, of the Palestinian population. Aid is part of that. Again, this is all in theory. Israel, as the, I guess it's now becoming the occupying power of Gaza, has a responsibility also to the civilian population to ensure that they are, you know, that it is discharging its duties as an occupying power. That all being said, how do we work this out practically? How do we even secure the port without boots on the ground? That's a question that, you know, is not answered with what we heard from the State of the Union. And you brought up all these historical examples of where well-intentioned American humanitarian interventions have quickly gone belly up. Beirut was a perfect example where U.S. forces went in to ensure the safety and security of Palestinian civilians after Sabra Shatila, to kind of pull apart all the forces that were clashing in Beirut. And in the end, we exposed ourselves and our troops to attacks by proto-Hezbollah, Iranian assets. It's not like Gaza has any lack of Iranian assets. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, definitely, I could see taking an order from Iran to make the Americans bleed on the ground. So I would hope that whomever is planning out this idea has a well thought out plan for how to secure our forces on the ground. Because again, I just, like you, I don't buy the idea that this can be implemented without US troops on the ground. The other part is, look, maybe it's not even attacks on U.S. forces, but what are we getting involved in? We saw the aid convoy that went into to Gaza. It was about a week ago, and the debacle that happened between the aid, Palestinian civilians getting trampled, Palestinians moving towards an Israeli position in a threatening manner, and some 10 to 12 of them, according to the Israelis, being killed. Now, this isn't something that necessarily threatened Israeli forces, but the delivery of aid is in and of itself, in a war zone, a very complicated endeavor. It's not just a risk to the lives and safety of our soldiers that we might be putting forward, but also, what about our reputation in case something bad happens? Just as an example, if you heard today, the airdrops that we've been doing into Gaza, the aid airdrops, accidentally killed 5 people. Right? How can you guarantee that a situation where you have more friction on the ground doesn't also result in something that ends up damaging the image and the reputation of the United States? Again, good idea in theory. It's a noble idea in theory, but when we get down to brass tacks, I think there's a lot of complication that factors into this, and it ends up looking, I hate to say this, but increasingly like a campaign stump speech, right? This is something where the Biden administration in an election year, rather the Biden campaign, is using to shore up a flagging far left flank by demonstrating concern for the civilians in Gaza, even if there is a risk, a risk of harm to U.S. interests and U.S. troops.
Yeah, I go back to Kabul, right? I mean, that's a different, right? We're conducting an evacuation, but just look how quickly that turned the visuals from there. And the U.S. became responsible for securing that airport, for getting people through the gates, partnering with the Taliban, getting that suicide attack at the Abbey Gate that killed 13 Americans. So you make an excellent point, David. As soon as we insert ourselves into that situation, we have ownership of it and the optics that come with it. Look, I don't want Palestinians to starve, but I have found in my experience with covering these wars and studying other wars as well, the longer you drag them out, the more devastating they are for the civilians that are caught into the crossfire. The best thing for this war would for it to end swiftly. You could take casualties on the front end, or you could extend casualties over time. There's pluses and minuses to each, but I'm a believer in getting wars done quickly. And I'm certain this is not in the best interest. You just had the director of the USAID come out the other day and say, essentially, we can't ensure that Hamas is not receiving these supplies. And let's face it, in a war zone, in any siege, who's fed first? Who gets the medical supplies first? It's always going to be the military. They're the ones that hold the guns. They're the ones that are going to be able to control and distribute aid. So
agreed. And we're not dealing with a noble fighting force demonstrably, they have no care for the civilian population. They're not going to prioritize their needs. We've seen videos and reports coming out of Hamas interdicting humanitarian shipments, shooting Palestinians who've been trying to get food and supplies. So the expectation that this is going to be different with this port, I think, is naive. And again, what you mentioned, the reputational harm that can be done to the United States. The images that came out of Afghanistan, look, perhaps there's no other way to conduct an evacuation other than that. Perhaps that is the inevitable outcome every time you leave a country where, it is overrun by an opposing force. Perhaps the images themselves, right, of Afghans latching onto planes as they fall to their doom afterwards, that's something that's going to be etched. It should be etched in our memory as the American people, but also it's going to be etched into the global memory that this is American callousness. That's how it's going to be presented. This is cannon fodder or grist for the propaganda mills of the Iranian regime and any of our adversaries that, hey, look, this is the great and vaunted United States that cares so much about civilians. And look, Mogadishu, right? As we had to rescue our forces, harm had to be done. And what reputational risk what reputational harm did we incur as a result? Likewise, in Beirut, we are presented as having entered Lebanon as occupiers when we, in fact, deployed our forces in peace to save the Lebanese from themselves, but also to create a buffer zone between our chief ally in the region and the Lebanese civilians and the Palestinian refugee population. There, we're not given credit for that, right? Quite the opposite. We are presented as having colluded with the Israelis and are responsible for even the worst excesses of the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. You know, imagining something like that happening in Gaza it doesn't take a stretch of the imagination at all. We just need to point to what happened with the Israelis themselves last week. And, you know, the facts don't matter. We understand this at this point. There is a media campaign. There is a propaganda campaign that's being waged by the other side. And all that matters is the image of you know, dead Palestinian civilians, hungry dead Palestinian civilians who are just trying to get some food. And all the other facts, how they died, you know, the threat that the Israeli forces felt, and whether they were right to use force in response, all of that is a lot of nuance and details that the average person does not care about. When you have such an emotionally charged image of starving people dying as they're trying to get food, we're walking into a mess. And I think there are better ways to get this done than involving ourselves this deeply.
You had mentioned what happened a week ago, right? Desperate civilians, that things tend to turn very sideways when people are hungry, when they don't have what they need to live. And inserting, you know, at the very least, and I realize I'm mentioning, you know, Kabul in 2021, we had no choice, right? The U.S. had to withdraw. Now, how that was conducted, my point being the images that come, you know, how this, you insert, we didn't directly insert ourselves in an evacuation. Mogadishu, very different. The U.S., you know, had good intentions. Same thing with Lebanon. Inserting yourselves in these conflicts, it needs to be thought through, and don't think that that Hamas and the news agencies aren't going to set up cameras and run them 24/7, just waiting for that moment. And, you know, one other thing too, David, I mean, you know, on one hand, you know, the Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad or Hezbollah or Iran, they may decide, all right, let the aid in. You want the Palestinians to get food. We don't want to poke the American bear. But on the other hand, if depending on how they're reading the situation, they might smell weakness and may want to instigate, aside from just the chance of just things going bad because of desperation of civilians. We also have to consider that malign actors here are going to take advantage of this situation. I mean, I just hope those in the Biden administration, the military intelligence services, are gaming this out, because they certainly didn't do this in Afghanistan with the withdrawal. Partnering with the Taliban, which in my opinion, either knew that an Islamic State suicide bomber was coming through and turned a blind eye, or actually encouraged it in order to get one last shot out against the Americans on the way out the door. Yeah, I know people say that's conspiracy theory, but you know what? The group that was securing the airport at Kabul, called Badri 313, that's a Haqqani network, which deals with suicide bombers. I think they know what they look like, and I think they know who each other are. They certainly do. But anyway, I digress. David, we're at yesterday marked the fifth month of war, the fifth month since Hamas and company launched its deadly attack in southern Israel. Just horrific. Where does the war stand today? Who's winning? Who's losing? And how do you rate, particularly, I'm interested, because Hezbollah has been a real enigma to me in this. They've launched this sort of steady state of attacks, a near daily grind. They just enough not to cause a full escalation. Obviously, the Israelis are focused on Gaza at the moment, and they don't want to fight a two front war fully. What's your opinion on the state of the war and Hezbollah's, you know, how do they rate in this?
Look, in pure numbers, there's a huge disparity. Just today, three additional Hezbollah fighters were killed. Hezbollah keeps issuing on a monthly basis now these infographics where they update the number of attacks. Interestingly, the number of attacks has gone up by about 233 between, I want to say, February 5th and March 5th, when they released the second this kind of follow-up infographic. So it's now a little bit over 1,000. The number of Israeli dead or Israeli casualties, right? They have 2,000 dead and wounded. They don't really specify what on the Israeli side. They haven't updated that at all. They don't tell you how the wounded are happened. They're trying to create this impression that they've made the Israelis bleed if not more so, at least just as much as the Israelis have made them bleed. Hassan Nasrallah keeps trying to make this argument in every speech that he delivers, that the Israelis are hiding their casualty numbers on the Northern Front. He's talking about thousands. There's nothing to substantiate this. I think the numbers on the Israeli side stand about 13 or 14 civilians and soldiers killed total. So the Israelis are definitely, in terms of the casualty number, definitely on the winning end. Destruction of assets. I think the Israelis are also able to target Hezbollah assets at will far more easily than the Hezbollah is able to strike into Israel. That's not to say that Hezbollah strikes don't pose a threat. They're not destructive. They're not dangerous. But the Israelis are far more lethal, and I think they're bringing that to bear. So in terms of the balance of forces, the Israelis have the upper hand. But that's not the totality of the picture, right? Where do you go from here? I think that's the issue, right? If there is a return to the status quo ante through either some peace negotiation or some ceasefire negotiation, then the Israelis have lost, right? Because this is the definition of victory that Hezbollah has always relied upon. If they are able to survive the day after, then they will declare themselves victorious. And I assure you, if somehow a ceasefire is achieved where there is no detriment to Hezbollah, then they will come out claiming victory. They will come out claiming that, you know, they were able to set equations and so on and so forth. This is going to strengthen them internally if they come out claiming a victory. If the Israelis aren't demonstrably victorious in this war of attrition. And this kind of brings me to the ceasefire proposals and why they're problematic. Nothing on the table now would do any harm, any long-term harm, to Hezbollah's deployment, its capabilities. It is a return to the status quo ante, right? Early February, we were hearing reports from, I think it was Reuters, the French were proposing an 8 to 10 kilometer Hezbollah withdrawal, not all of Hezbollah, but just the elite Redwan force, or just their commando force from the border. This is far below the 40 kilometers that's required by UN Security Council Resolution 1701, which would put Hezbollah north of the Litani River. 10 kilometers is nothing relative to that. Then there was another report in Axios that I think this is Amos Hochstein's proposal, that there would be no withdrawal required. It would be more of a stay in place. So those forces that had withdrawn would remain withdrawn. Those that remained would remain, just kind of like freeze things in place as it is. And then there was a report 2 days ago or yesterday in the Idat al-Watan, which is a Lebanese newspaper, that Amos Hochstein has basically dropped any withdrawal requirement at all. That he's not mentioned this in any of his meetings. That this is basically he's focused right now on just achieving a ceasefire at any cost on the northern border, and no preconditions. And not only are there no preconditions, Lebanon, in order to, and I'm quoting the Axios report, in order to sweeten the deal for Hezbollah, and I think that was the exact term used, sweeten the deal, Lebanon is being offered this package of incentives, economic incentives. And why this is beneficial to Hezbollah, Hezbollah exists in Lebanon. Its objective is to grow in Lebanon. You can't grow while the house around you is collapsing. So even though Hezbollah is primarily loyal to Iran, they have an interest in Lebanon not collapsing in around them. This is why we've seen during the past 4 years going on of Lebanon's economic collapse. With the exception of all their behavior since October 8th, Hezbollah has acted in a relatively far more restrained fashion than what we saw before. And we can talk about like why they're less restrained since October 8th, but Lebanon's economic collapse puts pressure on Hezbollah. So by alleviating that, and you have an unrepentant Hezbollah that's still armed, that's still, you know, acting independently, you've set things back to the status quo ante and then some. You've given Hezbollah more room to act. And then when you look at what these proposals entail, you realize that this is a windfall for the Lebanese side of the equation, where in this instance, I will include Hezbollah as part of that. We're hearing talk of reviving the deal that would allow Egyptian gas to be converted to electricity in Jordan, then transferred to Lebanon through Syria. Obviously, Syria is going to get a benefit, and Lebanon is going to get exemptions to the CSER sanctions, the CSER Act sanctions, because there is going to be a benefit that accrues to the Syrian regime and not just to Lebanon. This ends up kind of on the balance harming our interests regionally, because the Assad regime is an adversary, and now it's a wholly owned subsidiary of the Iranian regime. there would be other economic incentives to help Lebanon's flagging economy. Again, this alleviates the burden off of not just Hezbollah, but the corrupt political class in Lebanon that continues to dominate the country, that continues to refuse to implement any economic or political reforms that are necessary to turn Lebanon from, if not a failed state, a definitely failing state, into a productive member of the international community. And there is talk about future border demarcations. This has been a Lebanese demand. This is why I'm putting Hezbollah in the Lebanese camp this time, because since October 8th, the way the Lebanese government has operated is identifying an opportunity in Hezbollah's attacks and the international community's, if I may call it, obsessive aversion to the start of a full Hezbollah-Israel war, to basically blackmail the international community into concessions like the ones that I mentioned, and to extract concessions from the Israelis on matters that the Lebanese view as being of national importance. This is basically what they did leading up to the maritime border deal, right? The international community did not want a Hezbollah-Israel war. Hezbollah would threaten or kind of engage at the time in performative attacks, right? They buzzed the Karish field several times with drones. And Nasrallah would send threats to Amos Hochstein through Abbas Ibrahim. This is a guy who was the former director general of General Security. We've always considered him our interlocutor. Turns out he was Nasrallah's message boy by his own admission. So Nasrallah would threaten. He would convey the messages to Amos Hochstein, and Amos Hochstein would convey that to the Israelis and say, hey guys, we want to avoid a war. Let's just get this done. If that sounds familiar, it's because this is exactly what's happening now. So one of the Lebanese demands is that, this is Foreign Minister Abdullah Bouhabib has said this more than once, like, we don't work for the Israelis. If they want their civilians to return to northern Israel, to their homes in northern Israel, we need to get something too. And what we want is border demarcation. So there are 13 points of dispute along the blue line, which is not a border. It's a provisional border, you could call it, but it's not an international border between Israel and Lebanon. They want these 13 points to be resolved in exchange, they're saying, for 1701 implementation. Now, maybe that sounds like a good deal, right? You give Lebanon these bonuses and you get full implementation of 1701, which includes disarming Hezbollah at maximum, or at least distancing it from the border. Who cares about some minor territorial changes? Except that's not what the Lebanese are actually promising if you listen to them. Abdullah Bouhabib, in the same statement, was pressed and asked, okay, so the Israelis give you everything. The borders, there's finally an international border between Lebanon and Israel. The maritime border is demarcated. Can you then act against Hezbollah? He said no. He said, we'll see. His exact words were, we'll see. He's like, we may not succeed. So Lebanon would get everything and cannot even guarantee that it can meet its end of the bargain. So this, to me, sounds more like coercive diplomacy. That's the polite way of putting it. Blackmail, rather than a genuine good faith deal that would permanently put an end to the underlying causes of a potential war that would impact Lebanon and Israel, namely Hezbollah's armed strength. There's nothing on the table that would impact Hezbollah's armed strength or its deployment along the border. So if we end up in that situation, irrespective of whatever gains the Israelis are making now in this tit-for-tat war, ultimately Hezbollah comes out the winner.
So several questions stem from that. Why is Israel maintaining that maritime deal, given what's happened here? Is any insight onto that, or is it just they have a lot more fish to fry here?
Maintaining the maritime deal, look, I think from the Israeli perspective, this is an international border. They have no interest in undermining that now that it's been demarcated, right? They're letting sleeping dogs lie.
It already happened. They're not going to, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Although I will add one thing on this, and this is kind of like the game the Lebanese continue playing. So this deal was signed on October 30th, 2022, if I recall correctly. That same day, Nasrallah had a speech where he said, yeah, this is all fine and dandy. There's still 2.5 square kilometers of Lebanese maritime border or maritime waters, Lebanese territorial waters that are being held by the Israelis. This is occupied territory that is occupied by the enemy, and it is the duty of the people, the army, and the resistance to liberate it at some point in the future. So where the Israelis walked away thinking they were getting a settled border, what they really got is the potential for a blue line 2.0 situation where, again, the Israelis withdrew to what was perceived to be the international border on May 25th, 2000. UN Security Council comes in and certifies the Israeli withdrawal. Lebanese start with then the reservations with the Shebaa farms. Now it's 13 different points of dispute. And there are what they call the seven villages. The seven villages are, so the border, the international boundary between Lebanon and Israel is poorly demarcated. I actually recommend Asher Kaufman's study on this if anyone's interested in why it's such a poorly demarcated border. But there is an international border in theory. This was the border between mandatory Lebanon that was under the French and mandatory Palestine under the British. In 1923, the Palette-Newcombe Agreement demarcated an international border between these two mandatory holdings. These seven villages at that point were ceded by the French mandatory powers to mandatory Palestine. This was a final border. When Lebanon came into existence, these territories were not part of its sovereign territory. When Israel came into existence later, they were part of Israeli sovereign territory. Now, several of them, if I'm not mistaken, are populated in kibbutzim and moshavim there. The Lebanese are claiming them as well. So there's always this kind of, you know, you give an inch, you wait for the mile to come. So that's another risk. We're already seeing this with this 2.5 kilometers square, allegedly that Hezbollah is, and you know, I don't know if the Lebanese state is also saying they're reserving the right to talk about this later, but even if you demarcate the 13 points along the border, there is the issue of the seven villages that were supposed to be part of Israel per the first international boundary that was drawn, dividing mandatory Palestine from the French mandate over Lebanon. So it's kind of an endless endeavor, and it's not one that's being conducted in good faith by the Lebanese side.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Not in good faith. And one wonders if the seven villages and the blue, it's all resolved. They're going to find a rock, a stone, and something that they're, you know, Hezbollah. It's almost like they're looking for excuses for resistance, right?
They are, right? And at the end of the day, Hezbollah's goal is the destruction
of Israel. So this is all just talk. Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing we get caught up in these games, David, that very smart people with very big degrees in law and foreign policy and international relations just can't recognize what Hezbollah's game is here, or Hamas's game for that fact. And continually, you laid it out perfectly how the concessions are made and continually made. And it's just a perfect example of moving the goalposts. You had mentioned that Hezbollah has been less restrained since October 7th. Is this a function with Israel being preoccupied in Gaza? And also, David, I hate to throw two questions at once, but I'm known to do this. You mentioned the term status quo ante several times. Does Israel, by its inaction, risk a new normal of fighting along the border between Hezbollah with Hezbollah attacks? You know, again, previously, any one of these attacks that occur several times a day would have an Israeli response would have been massive. And now it's just a tit for tat now. And it's just, anyway, go ahead, David.
I think we've discussed this a little bit in the past, right? The Hezbollah is able to engage in this brinksmanship because of two factors. The first is that, yes, Israel, from the outset, it was obvious, was trying to focus on an unprecedented urban campaign in Gaza. Right? This is, yes, more Israeli forces are now being demobilized, but the focus is still on Gaza. You still have hostages there, right? There's a lot of, there's the military aspect and there's the political aspect that keeps the Israeli attention on Gaza. There's another aspect of it. And again, Hezbollah is not a stupid organization. They're capable of understanding kind of where Israel stands on the global scene right now, where Israel's relations with the United States stand. And a couple of things they've seen is that, the United States has made it very clear that they don't want a second front. Different statements that have been leaked to the media have seemed to place the onus on this on the Israelis. And that, to me, suggests that this administration would look at any campaign that breaks out in Lebanon as Israel's fault, rather than as a result, as a proportionate and legal reaction to Hezbollah's provocations, to their unjustified attacks that began October 8th. And it's not just American opprobrium that's the problem there, right? It's a matter of resupply, weapons resupply, right? Critical weapons, artillery shells, Iron Dome interceptors, which are going to prove more essential than ever if there is a full-on Israeli war with Hezbollah. So this is something that's restraining the Israelis' hand. The second part is Israel needs diplomatic support, primarily from the United States, but also from its other Western allies when it engages in any campaign. It would not be possible for Israel to continue with the war in Gaza had the United States approved of, tabled, or allowed a ceasefire resolution to pass through the UN Security Council. This is something that also Israel has to take into consideration if it wants to engage in any ground operation in Lebanon. Hezbollah knows this. Hezbollah knows these two factors weigh on the Israeli calculus, and without them, Israel is not going to go all the way. So this gives Hezbollah leeway to, again, push the boundaries. Like you said, it's not just like you said. Nasrallah himself has said this several times, like a single one of these attacks in the past, and the Israelis would have just, you know, all hell would have broken loose. And, you know, he's chalked it up to, obviously, to, you know, the deterrence that the resistance has built up against Israel. It's chest puffing. He knows at the end of the day, it's American restraint on these American restraints on the Israelis that are preventing a full on campaign, and the constraints of the war in Gaza. This has allowed more brinksmanship, obviously. And sorry, the second question I'm trying to remember was
the new normal.
The new normal.
Do we risk a new normal?
It's hard to say. I don't think Hezbollah wants I don't think Hezbollah wants the situation that exists now to go on longer than it has to. Because as much as they're not admitting this, their side is also incurring the cost, right? There are also displaced people on the Lebanese side. You have reports that the destruction that the Israelis are meeting out in these border villages that they're targeting somehow, in some cases, exceeded that of the Second Lebanon War. Now, whether that's an exaggeration or not remains to be seen, but there is a price that's being paid on the other side. And it's a price that's being paid not for Lebanon. It's not that the Israelis are invading Lebanon. This is about a war. And Hezbollah has made this very clear that this is, you know, Muslim from the Shab Gaza. This is in support of the people of Gaza. But the Lebanese people are suffering. Right? Its own support base is suffering. The longer this goes on, I think the more people are going to say, why do we need to go through this? I want to go back home. Oh, wait, I don't have a home to go back to. Whose fault is this? From the Israeli side, I think there actually is an interest in creating a new normal. One of the more ridiculous things that I've seen in the Israeli-Hezbollah conflict is that the weaker side, namely Hezbollah, has been able to set all the red lines. This war between these two sides has been going on since 1982. And at different phases, different rules of engagement have dominated, particularly over the past 10 years. And this is something I pointed out in several articles I've written. Hezbollah has been setting those red lines, the outer limits of what's acceptable and what's not. Particularly since the outbreak of the Syrian civil war, we've seen Israel conducting what's called the Milchama bin Milchamot, the war between the wars. This campaign that has basically manifested itself as periodic airstrikes against Hezbollah assets and weapons shipments in Syria. But it's almost like a game of tag, because once those weapons shipments cross what is increasingly an artificial border between Lebanon and Syria, because Hezbollah has made it an artificial border, that's it. These weapons are off limits. Hezbollah's assets, there have been reports, I wrote this for LWJ, I think back in 2016, that Hezbollah had, under Iranian guidance, established weapons factories to manufacture, you know, different types of missiles, probably more short-range stuff within Lebanon. These short-range missiles pose a serious threat because of their quantity to northern Israel. But these factories are off limits because of the rules that Hezbollah has set, that Lebanon is off limits and that Israel has accepted. It is an absurd situation. And I think it is in the Israeli interest to expand, let's say, you know, the ceasefire proposals go into effect. I don't think the Israelis should stop in Syria. I think they should expand this conflict between the wars into Lebanon to target Hezbollah's assets in the same way that they do in Syria. Pinprick strikes that degrade its assets, that harm its capabilities. It's not going to prevent the war that is going to come one day between these two sides. Because Hezbollah has said it's inevitable. Hezbollah has said its entire energies, military energies, are focused on one day being able to attack the Israelis. But it's a speed bump. And in the absence of any other action by the international community in the absence of any ability or will on the part of the Lebanese government, and in the absence of any appetite by the international community for the Israelis to engage in a ground maneuver that could sufficiently degrade or destroy Hezbollah's assets, the expansion of the campaign between the wars, the Milchama bin HaMilchamot, into Lebanon, I think is a tool that the Israelis should use. It would allow Israel for the first time in a very long time to actually set the rules of engagement. And they can coerce Hezbollah. At the end of the day, look, Hezbollah can butt heads with the Israelis for a certain period of time. The Israelis actually have a much more tolerance for pain than Hezbollah does, because Israel's economy is stronger, its society is more durable, and the IDF is a much more powerful army. They can set the rules. It's going to be painful. We're going to probably see, you know, exchanges of fire in the north, but if the Israelis push the envelope, I think they can set new standards whereby they have the upper hand rather than Hezbollah.
So, David, you are saying that if there is a ceasefire, Hezbollah has said that it would abide by it, but you're saying that Israel should decouple the war in Gaza, yes, with Hamas and with Hezbollah. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, and I didn't even consider it that way, that doing so allows the Israelis to go after the assets, to go after the things that have been put off limit to the Israelis. So that's a very interesting perspective. And last question for you, David, is there a possibility that Israel is going to go after Hezbollah's leadership? Why has Nasrallah breathed for this long? And other top leadership within Hezbollah, you know, are the Israelis afraid of what might come next? Are they afraid of the impact? What's the reasoning here?
Look, I think there are several ways to break this down. First of all, yes, they are probably afraid of what comes next. If we go back to February 1992, assassination of Abbas Mousawi, Nasrallah's predecessor. We got Nasrallah afterwards, right? And Hezbollah's retaliation at the time, which is a much weaker Hezbollah, but they still found a way to retaliate against the Israelis twice by targeting the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires and then the Amia Jewish Community Center. So Hezbollah has ways of making the Israelis bleed without paying a consequence. The other issue now is if you kill Nasrallah, it's a declaration of war. And I think the Israelis will only do that in a situation of war, assuming he's reachable wherever he is. But it is a calculus that would lead to war. This isn't like killing commanders. I think killing someone as important as Nasrallah, if it's obvious the Israelis have done it, when Badreddin was killed, for example, in 2016, Hezbollah media initially flashed that the Israelis had done it. Then, all this stuff was pulled. I think I also wrote about this for LWA.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, I recall this. Yeah, it's amazing, David. Right? That's eight, nine years ago. How long I've been doing this work?
Yeah. But you know, then Hezbollah goes into this like conclave that reminds me of, you know, how the Pope is selected, right? And they utter silence, and then they come out and say ISIS did it. Why all of a sudden the change of narrative? Because if ISIS did it, you don't have to go and retaliate against the Israelis in a manner that is commensurate with the loss of a leader as big as Badreddin. You're busy in Syria. You don't want a war with the Israelis,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? If Nasrallah is killed, there's really very few ways, especially when, you know, Hezbollah is not active on any other fronts. There are very few ways for Hezbollah to avoid, even if they want to, even if they say, okay, this guy's just a symbol, we can replace him. He's such a big symbol. He's of such importance to Hezbollah that if he's killed by the Israelis, they can't avoid war. They have to draw blood, and enough blood that would give the Israelis justification for war. And again, the issue is, like, the question is, does Israel actually want the war? I don't think Israel wants the war. I think Israel sees no option but to fight this war because it's being imposed upon it by Hezbollah. But given the choice, right, I think they'd rather avoid this themselves. And therefore, Nasrallah continues to live.
The devil you know, I guess, right?
Yeah.
David, thanks so much for joining us today at Generation Jihad. We got to get you back on real soon. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure as well, Bill.
David, you have a great day, and thanks everyone for listening to today's episode of Generation Jihad. Just a reminder, you can listen to us on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe to Generation Jihad and leave us a review, preferably a positive one, but only if we earned it. Thanks again, and we'll see you all again real soon.